TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Christopher Hitchens, The Trial of Henry Kissinger, Part 2. Christopher Hitchens died on December 15, 2011, age 62, and his work on Kissinger stands strong in spite of controversial positions he took later when he supported the war in Iraq. At an important turning point in history, inspired by the October 1998 arrest of Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet in a residence in London upon a warrant issued in Spain, when an emerging global system of justice was beginning to function, Christopher Hitchens set out to make a profoundly well-researched indictment of Henry Kissinger. His book, The Trial of Henry Kissinger, contains some of the hundreds of records on covert operations that the CIA was forced to release for the Pinochet case. And Hitchens shows how that material also incriminates Henry Kissinger, both in the case of the murder of Chilean General Schneider and in the coup and assassination of Salvador Allende. But that was not all. Calling Kissinger a one-man global rolling crime wave, Hitchens made the case for Kissinger war crimes in Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, East Timor, Bangladesh, Cyprus, and even Washington, D.C. I recorded Hitchens presenting his indictment of Kissinger to a very engaged overflow audience in a bookstore in San Francisco in the fall of 2001. Here now is the question and answer section. In the lively exchange, Hitchens offered additional information on Kissinger's role in Israel, Palestine, and Cyprus. It all started with a burning question. Hitchens had asked whether the 1968 election was stolen by the Republicans.
In 1968, there was a United States presidential election in progress, and there was also in progress the same war of atrocity and aggression in Vietnam. And by the mid-summer of 1968, it's fair to say, the majority of the American political establishment, and probably a majority of the American people, had concluded that at the very best, this war was a great mistake, and the shortest way out of it would be the best way. And even Lyndon Johnson and Hubert Humphrey had sponsored peace negotiations in Paris with all parties to the conflict, and that was the Democrats' re-election platform for that year, the peace plank. And Richard Nixon, with three other men, evolved the following plan. He decided that he would go to the South Vietnamese military junta, secretly, and by the way, illegally, and make them the following proposition. If you withdraw from these talks in Paris, if you sabotage them by withdrawal, and if you do so in a timely fashion on the eve of the election, and if the Republican Party wins as a result of the collapse of the Democrats' re-election program, you'll get a better deal from the incoming administration. You won't hear all this talk about negotiations with Hanoi and halts to the bombing process and all of that. We won't inflict that upon you. It had to be done very carefully because it was extremely unlawful. And it used to be that this was a hypothesis in Washington, a conjecture, a theory. Some people would say a conspiracy theory. But it's no longer correct to call it that. It's now established as a matter of record that that's what those men did. We know it because President Johnson had Nixon's campaign plane bugged and his campaign headquarters bugged, and he recorded the treasonous transactions. And just last year, my friend Anthony Summers was able to get the FBI transcripts, and I have them in the book for your reading pleasure. The people who did that were Richard Nixon, John Mitchell, later Attorney General, and Spiro Agnew, later Vice President. And there was a fourth man, Henry Kissinger.
That was Christopher Hitchens' account of the 1968 election. Of course, in the question and answer period, the first question raised was, why did Johnson not make use of the secret tapes from Nixon's campaign plane? Here's Hitchens' response.
It's a good question, and the answer is this. It probably wasn't lawful to do that, though it was not as unlawful as what the Nixon gang had done. It probably wasn't lawful for Johnson to have put bugs on the campaign plane of the person who was trying to replace his vice president in the Oval Office. And it's certainly, even if it could have been found a basis in law, because J. Edgar Hoover knew about it and had been cognizant of it, it would have been very embarrassing to have to admit it. That's the first thing. The second thing is, and it's in the memoirs, I've assembled all the different fragments of memoir that go to make up this story now. They now all fit together with the tapes. Clark Clifford, who was then Secretary of Defense, and others, all met, and they said, we can't let the Nixon people get away with this. If we must take it to the public. We must say this is a scandal, an outrage, a subversion, treason. Now, Hubert Humphrey didn't want to do that, because Hubert Humphrey believed in bipartisanship. And what bipartisanship meant that year was, if the American people had any idea what was going on now, we already have a very unstable situation. There are riots in the ghettos. There are people burning their draft cards. There are soldiers shooting their officers in the back in Indochina. This would be a crisis of the system if we reveal what was going on here. So they had a private meeting with Nixon about it. But that's also what bipartisanship means, by the way. Mm-hmm. And they let it go. I think it was not the least of the crimes of the Johnson-Humphrey administration. It's interesting, it surfaces later in the Watergate period. When Nixon had been found bugging the Democrats, he threatened to go public, saying, this isn't the first time this kind of thing has happened. And he even urged Haldeman and some of his deputies, and I have their accounts of it, to make public the facts. But it was then pointed out to him he couldn't do that without revealing what he'd been doing when they were bugging him. And at that point, he backed off. So it's one of those secrets that's known to everybody in Washington. But because it implicates the whole political class rather than any one party, it's not deemed fit to share with you, or me, or us. But I might add that one of the not very hidden agendas of this book is to, and especially in what I say about 68 and the later horror in Indochina, is to vindicate the memory of the anti-war movement, which is often written up these days with contempt or with hostility, or very often with distortion. Distortions that have quite rapidly become current in one's own lifetime, things one knows to be untrue. And I'm as hard as ice about this. We were right and they were wrong. The only regret anyone who was in that movement should have is for doing too little. If we had had any idea how much worse it was than we had suspected, we might have been able to generate the outrage and the hatred that would have been necessary to stop the war earlier than it was eventually stopped. And that's something I'm proud to say anywhere.
Do we know if Henry had his oar, was dipping his oar in matters of Palestine and Israel?
The question asks, do we know of any, it's a horrible metaphor, but he says dipping of Henry's oar into... into Israeli-Palestine matters. Well, the reason why this book isn't quite a lot thicker than it is this is not a book about all the awful things you should know about Henry Kissinger. If it was that, it would be five times its size. I deliberately leave out Angola, Kurdistan, a number of other places, precisely because they don't bear on the new situation with international law. I only go after bits of him where he can be identified as criminal, not just morally criminal. But I can tell you a good Israel-Palestine Kissinger story, if you like, which would also educate you to detest and distrust your mass media more.
Yes.
My great profession. Would you like that? Well, this is a few years ago. It must have been, in fact, 84, because it was at the beginning of the Intifada, the massive civil resistance movement in the occupied territories in Gaza. That came as a tremendous surprise to most Americans, partly because nothing in their mass media could possibly prepare them for the likelihood that a people living under a Pax Americana would risk death rather than carry on living under it. But be that as it may, it was a tremendous shock all round and met most people's definition of news. And there was a meeting in New York of senior members of the American Jewish community who were very disturbed and upset by this development. And they asked advice from various people, including Henry Kissinger, who came and gave them an off-the-record breakfast briefing in which he said that the crucial thing was to put down this rebellion with the utmost physical force and the least compunction in the shortest possible period of time, and that this would necessitate keeping the American press and mass media completely off the scene. The first thing to do would be to make sure that it couldn't be reported, because if it could be reported, what was needed to be done couldn't be done. Well, as soon as I read that, I knew who'd said it. okay? And it was soon confirmed that he had said that. Typical, by the way, of his fantastic dreamland ruthlessness. I mean, a stupid plan as well as an evil one, if you follow me. But nasty enough for people at the meeting, to their credit, to leak it. And people said, oh, well, you know, what a terrible thing for Henry Kissinger to say, and maybe we should, you know, wonder if there isn't the possibility of a political settlement with these Palestinian types, these chaps, who forced themselves on our attention. And I thought, well, that's all very interesting. What I want to know is Henry Kissinger still the consultant for ABC News, having made this recommendation? Made the recommendation that the American media be kept out of the scene altogether. So I rang Mr. Koppel, who had the decency to call me back, and I said, I have three questions for you. One, what is your comment on Henry Kissinger calling for the violent suppression of the rebellion in the occupied territories and the exclusion of ABC News, CNN, every other outlet from the scene? Second, how much do you pay him to be your news consultant? And third, is it true that he, Mr. Kissinger, once said that if he was again to be Secretary of State, he would ask you, Mr. Koppel, to be his Assistant Secretary for Europe? And Koppel said, no comment on the first. Disappointing, but not surprising. I'm not telling you on the second, that's the money. And yes to the third. Yes, I would consider it an honor to serve Henry Kissinger as Assistant Secretary. Well, there you have it. And that's the egghead show. That's what's meant by the ideology of objectivity, by the way. There's no bias in that presentation.
I'm interested in, on a couple of different levels, what kind of response you've had so far.
The questioner asked if, what sort of response I've had, whether any of it's been unpleasant. I think that would cover it, wouldn't it? Well, the answer would be this. Try not to make it too long a story. I did send Kissinger a long email asking for an interview, and I didn't hear back. And then I was at that stage working on a version of this book for Harper's Magazine. So we thought, okay, well, we asked him. No one can say we didn't try. No reply. So then sent another email saying, this was actually my individual one. But I said, look, perhaps I should be the one to break the ice. I'm sorry I haven't heard back from you. I think I see a potential embarrassment here, and I should be the one to mention it. If it's a matter of money, because we know you like to charge for your opinions, we are prepared to offer you some. And we don't have very much, but could we say that if you would sit down for an hour and answer our questions on East Timor, on Chile, on Bangladesh, which I haven't had time to mention this evening, on Cyprus, we would pay you what Ted Koppel pays you for an average nightline, on condition that we could ask you the questions that he never asks. So I got back a really tear-stained letter that time from an underling called William Rogers, not the former Secretary of State, another one, Kissinger's former Undersecretary of State for Latin America, who is also a partner in Kissinger Associates, and a partner in Arnold & Porter, one of the white shoe law firms in Washington, D.C. And I wasn't sure in which capacity he was replying, but he said it was the most disgraceful suggestion he'd ever heard. It was unbelievably outrageous, and he couldn't say enough about how his feelings were hurt and his whole trust in me had been completely spoiled. So I wrote back and said, I think you're the same William Rogers who appears in the minutes of the meeting between Henry Kissinger and Augusto Pinochet in Santiago de Chile in September 1976, where the threats were issued against Orlando Letelier, who was later blown up, and where a plan was made to circumvent the wishes of the U.S. Congress in cutting off military aid to the dictatorship. But the minutes at that meeting show that you didn't say anything while that was being discussed, so I'm grateful now to know what it takes to arouse your sense of outrage. But then I'm sorry to say I said, you, and so signed off Crystal. And that was our last contact. We've had, the only other thing that's happened, there's a very good website called Britannica.com, some of you may know it, which did a summary of my case against Kissinger and put it out for people to read, and then invited me to take part in an online chat. And it was cancelled an hour before it went out, and the website was torn down. And I know that the people who own Britannica.com are on the same board as Kissinger Associates. And I actually know someone who's on the board who told me that I was right to suspect what I suspected. But I thought, that's pretty pathetic. And I can't say that Kissinger put them up to it. I mean, when you think what people have been through in Chile or in Cyprus, it's really not much to put beside it. Yes. I'm always glad to have a question like this one, which asks me to say a bit about the island of Cyprus, which was actually the first place I came across Kissinger's footprints. Roughly speaking, I don't know how many of you know how much about it, but Cyprus is a small island. It's the third largest island in the Mediterranean after Sicily and Sardinia. It's an independent democratic republic, the far east of the Mediterranean, commanding the entrance to the Suez Canal and very close to Lebanon, Syria, Israel, Palestine. And the majority of its inhabitants are Greek-speaking. And in 1974, it was the only part of the Greek-speaking world that was not under military rule. The rest of Greece was under the rule of a military dictatorship of a fascist cast of mind, which was exactly the kind of relationship Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon thought it ought to have to the United States, which had helped impose it. It wanted to extend its rule to Cyprus, to try and annex this neighboring democracy. And the symbol of the democracy of Cyprus was the man who'd led it to independence, President Makarios, who was also the archbishop of the Greek Orthodox congregation on the island. Slightly too little separation of church and state for my taste, but not a bad guy and a Democrat, and elected. And very much the same order of business was followed as I've described in other events. People thought, well, if we want to get Cyprus under control, we don't want a neutralist, democratic, open society island that near to the oil fields of the Middle East and the Suez Canal. We have to bring it under control. Well, that would mean removing Makarios. Well, that would mean having him killed. These meetings all did occur, and the assassination attempt did take place, backed up by a military coup. All of it with the foreknowledge and approval of Henry Kissinger. The assassination attempt didn't work. There were people prepared to fight and defend Makarios, and they saved his life. But the coup did work. His government was destroyed, and it did lead to a disastrous war with Turkey and an invasion which has subsequently led to an occupation, a colonization, a mass expulsion, the importation of settlers, the imposing of partition, and the creation of a terrible regional arms race within NATO between Greece and Turkey, to which you won't be surprised to hear the United States busily sells arms to both sides. Given those odds, by the way, and that triangulation of forces, it's interesting to find that Kissinger, who in the second volume of his memoirs refused to discuss what he'd done in Cyprus, he wouldn't go near it. Lots of things don't appear in his memoirs, by the way. The name East Timor doesn't appear even in the index. The name Orlando Letelier doesn't appear in the index. But he says in his third volume, when he has to address the Cyprus question, that the proximate cause of all the problems in Cyprus was Archbishop Makarios. So he confirmed everything in his own leaden prose that one had ever suspected. No, the problem is not that there's a military dictatorship in Greece, that the Turkish army is poised to invade, that there are fascist gangs trying to conduct ethnic cleansing in both directions. And that's not the problem at all. The problem is the place has a democratically elected president. He's the proximate cause. Well, if he's the proximate cause, it can only be right to have him iced, can't it?
What's your explanation for the fact that those in the left, such as it is, have allowed him to flourish on the East Coast, teach a class at Columbia without any kind of protest?
I don't think he does teach a class at Columbia. He may have done. I know there was an attempt to appoint him to some honorific office at Columbia, but there was a big protest about that. He was made Chancellor of William and Mary University in Williamsburg the other day, whose first chancellor was George Washington. And I went down there to speak at what was actually a very big event, people protesting against it. The head of the Board of Regents at William and Mary is Lawrence Eagleburger, who's a partner in Kissinger Associates and who brought to Kissinger Associates the business of Slobodan Milosevic. So I've actually been reasonably heartened at evenings like this and elsewhere at the fact that people still do remember what it is that is completely unpardonable about this person. What I do object to, though, is the Los Angeles Times running his feature, his column as a neutral thing. And in the Washington Post, for example, which reprints it, it took an enormous campaign we had to get congressmen involved and lots of letters written to the editor of the Post to say, don't identify the author of this column as former Secretary of State. He's writing about China today. It should say that he's the chairman of China Ventures Incorporated, a wholly owned subsidiary of Kissinger Associates that franchises American corporations to Chinese Stalinists, and is the reason why Henry Kissinger, well, you couldn't put all this in there. But, you know, something could be said about the conflict of interest. The same when he was writing about Mexico. He was then in the pocket of the Zedillo regime in Mexico. Quite a lot of them are going to jail, too, I'm pleased to see. It's a scandal. Actually, I could not say enough about the contempt I feel for my profession in this respect. They have completely abdicated the role of journalism in the minutest details and become really lapdog, not watchdog, shall we say. The lady wants to know what's the situation with international tribunals and their jurisdiction, not just for wrongful death matters, but for war crimes, and whether or not there's any precedent of an American being hauled before one. No. And there won't be one in The Hague either, because The Hague, the new International Criminal Court, quite correctly, doesn't have retrospective, or do I mean retroactive, jurisdiction. In other words, it can't consider any matter before it was set up. There is an inter-American court, which hasn't met much lately, but wasn't able to meet while most of its members' states were dictatorships. There is a court, a forum in the Americas, before which an American could be asked to appear. There are prosecutors in Chile, in the Pinochet case, who want to extend the prosecution to include Henry Kissinger and the people who invented Pinochet, and who want to extradite him and or subpoena him. And the United States would then be in a very ticklish position of having to say, well, we're not going to give up any of our people to your trial, right? And that would be embarrassing, and that could happen, too. Incidentally, for a corollary, I'm wandering a bit from your point, but I'm afraid the basic answer is no, not yet. For a corollary, a few weeks after Pinochet threatened Orlando Letelier, a well-known Chilean exile and dissident living in Washington, D.C., threatened him twice at a meeting with Henry Kissinger, of which I have the transcript. A few weeks after those threats were made, Orlando Letelier's car was blown up in rush hour traffic in downtown Washington, D.C., a few hundred yards actually from where I live, and he and his American friend and comrade, and at that moment driver, Ronnie Moffitt, were blown to pieces. Now, it's actually still illegal to let off car bombs in downtown Washington, D.C., at a rush hour time, or actually any other time. And it's illegal to do it even if you don't kill an American citizen. It's taken a very, very long time to establish the chain of command that led to that bomb going off, but it is now as much of a lay-down case in the opposite direction as Kissinger's orders to have Rene Schneider murdered are in the preceding case. So the Justice Department Criminal Division now has the job of finding a reason not to issue an indictment of Augusto Pinochet. They have all the evidence now in their possession. If they do not do it, it would, in my opinion, constitute grounds for the impeachment of the Attorney General, John Ashcroft, if he doesn't do it. And something to write to your congressman about. Write to your congressman righteously and say, excuse me, is it the case that we are not going to proceed against a foreign dictator who lets off car bombs on American soil? I'd like to see them get out of that. The second question would be, how has it taken so long to establish this fairly elementary chain of command? Because there was a lot of obstruction of justice, wasn't there? And destruction of evidence, and intimidation of witnesses in Washington, D.C. So I think that what we're looking at actually is microcosmic revenges for macrocosmic crimes. I'm afraid that's the way the law very often does proceed, as it did with Pinochet. But it expands all right. You can take heart from that. And it should. And I believe, I really do believe, will. But it's going to take a much wider awareness of it and a lot more publicity before that happens.
Has the U.S. ever prosecuted any of its own highest-level officials?
The questioner asks, has the U.S. government ever prosecuted a high-level official for war crimes? The answer is no, that it has not, but General Telford Taylor, who was the senior United States military prosecutor at Nuremberg, went on to write a book called Nuremberg and Vietnam, comparing the standards and the evidence and asking the question, had the U.S. military policy in Indochina crossed that line? And he answered it pretty much in the affirmative. And he wrote that book by the way, before the bombing of Cambodia was undertaken or disclosed. And he pointed out that the United States had at Nuremberg sworn to be judged by the same standards that it was imposing in that court. It caused those standards to be written into the founding documents of the United Nations, of which it remains the senior member as well as the host country, in many ways the founding member, so that the basis for such a judgment does in fact exist. It's a matter of what's sometimes called political will.
That was Christopher Hitchens presenting his case for bringing Henry Kissinger to justice for war crimes. I recorded him in front of an overflow audience in a San Francisco bookstore in the fall of 2001. Christopher Hitchens died on December 15, 2011, age 62, of cancer. He was a columnist, editor, and investigative journalist and wrote 17 books, including God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything, Cyprus from the Ottomans to Kissinger, The Missionary Position, Mother Teresa in Theory and Practice, and a memoir, Hitch 22. Hitchens' work on Kissinger in particular, and his making the case for a global system of justice in general, can serve as an inspiration to those who feel that war crimes in the Congo, the Central African Republic, Uganda, Sudan, the recent Libyan uprising, and post-election violence in Kenya and Ivory Coast that are now before the International Criminal Court are not the only such crimes committed since 2002, when the jurisdiction of the ICC began. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. For an audio CD of The Trial of Henry Kissinger, call anytime at 707-463-2654, and I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD order keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654. For information on how to order, you can get your CD by mail or credit card by phone or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. TUC Radio takes its name from an aeronautical term. Time of useful consciousness is the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness, the brief moment in which a pilot may save the plane. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.